This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're on remote again, but we're with Joseph Bassano, and that's going to make all the lights in the world go on today. Joseph, I found him on Facebook, so there's one plus for technology. But then I found out he was nationally known, internationally regarded, and so today he is all ours. So, Joseph, give us a poem.
Wonderful to be here with you, Grace. This is a poem called Letter. Tonight, as you walk out into the stars or the forest or the city, look up as you must have looked before love came, before love went, before ash was ash. Look at them, the city's mists, the winters, and the moon's glass you must have held in the beginning. That new moon you must have touched once in the waters, saying, change me, change me, change me. All I want is to be more of what I am.
The voice of Joseph Bassano. You know, a lot of people have said to me that when they read your work, they're reminded of Mary Oliver. Why do you think that is?
It's funny because, you know, there was a conversation on social media recently about Mary Oliver. I think we're in a stage right now where people are very much craving a kind of work that is immediately, viscerally accessible. And I think that we're also in a moment when people kind of distrust that kind of work. I will say this, that I try to use my knowledge of poetic craft to create something that does indeed have an immediate effect. And I think that, I try not to create things that are simple in a pejorative sense, but I do try to create work that values the reader, and that allows the reader to enter the mysteries of the poem. And so perhaps the comparison exists because of a certain tone, a certain sense of openness to the world and its possibilities. And I don't really have a fear of being vulnerable in the work.
There you have it. You don't have a fear. You have no armor whatsoever. But you know, lots of people do, Joseph. Lots of people want the reader to be accessible. Lots of people, but you do it in a way which is inimitable. So, I mean, everybody wants what you are talking about, but how do you accomplish it?
I think that one of the things that I try to do is believe that poetry is first and foremost an art of the orchestration of the body. I admire, for example, poets, whether they be Rainer Maria Rilke or John Ashbery, as different as they might be, who are able to, as I often tell my students, think with the body. There are no thoughts that are detached from considerations of rhythm in language, engagement with cadences. Robert Pinsky makes the point about rhyme in contemporary poetry. And he says often people get, you know, this mistaken sense that contemporary poetry, for the most part, doesn't rhyme. He says, no, it's just rhyming in a different way. And if you look at my poetry, there's a great deal, for example, going on with sound and with rhyming. It's just a little bit buried and hidden to try to create that feeling of hopefully inevitability when one gets to the end of the poem. So I care about craft very, very deeply. And the occasionally seemingly simple surface of the poem is an illusion, really.
Very well said, because craft is a secret, isn't it? And if you didn't have the bones, you would not deliver the goods. Let's have two poems by Joseph Bassano. We feel really happy today.
I'd like to share a poem that grew out of my thinking about love and perhaps the way we need to come into the messiness of it. And so it takes as its point of departure the great story of Penelope and Odysseus. Penelope and Odysseus. Not the moment when he slays the suitors in the palace, their wild cries thicker than history. Not the moment when he shows them all his great deeds, the dark scars where they tied him from the sirens. Not the moment someone touches him in wonder and feels Hector's death, the flames of Troy, no land. Not any of those moments, no. Not those, but the moment he stands face to face with only her and takes off the last of his armor, and she comes to him and touches his shoulder. History is what happens when we step out of the myths and see the real mess standing before us. Love is what happens after that. And I'd like to share a poem. It was one of my early poems, but I believe it was the first time I connected to some of the images inside my work. And it's a persona poem in the voice of Gustav Mahler. It's called Mahler in New York. Now when I go out, the wind pulls me into the grave. I go out to part the hair of a child I left behind, and he pushes his face into my cuffs to smell the wind. If I carry my father with me, it is the way a horse carries autumn in its mane. If I remember my brother, it is as if a buck had knelt down in a room I was in. I kneel, and the wind kneels down in me. What is it to have a history, a flock buried in the blindness of winter? Try crawling with two violins into the hallway of your father's hearse. It is filled with sparrows. Sometimes I go to the field, and the field is bare. There is the wind which entrusts me. There is a woman walking with a pail of milk, a man who tilts his bread in the sun. There is the black heart of a mare in the milk, or is it the wind, the way it goes? I don't know about the wind, about the way it goes. All I know is that sometimes someone will pick up the black violin of his childhood and start playing. That it sits there on his shoulder like a thin gray falcon asleep in its blinders, and that we carry each other this way because it is the way we would like to be carried, sometimes with mercy, sometimes without.
Joseph, the black violin of the childhood, the black violin, how did that come to you?
This was a poem I remember writing quite some time ago now. I'm in my 40s now. I believe I was in my mid-20s. And I think I was speaking to what it was at that moment to really start the work of poetry and to lift the pain and also the beauty of one's early years and one's struggles and try to transform it into something, really. Just try to begin that journey. Right. That we really all do. If we're poets, we do it in one way, but every life is looking to transform. Simone Weil said once, we must not wish for the disappearance of our troubles, but for the grace to transform them. And I believe that.
And Adrian Rich says to dive into the wreck of that. I have to talk about the formation of your poems, just listening to them. The power of the first poem with the anaphora, the repeat of the word not, not, not. So you build up this beautiful rhythm. And in the second, the way you use the shift of energies, your volta, like, sometimes you begin a phrase and you just shift all the energy. Another time you go, I don't know. So you start a phrase and you change the whole direction of it. And this doesn't come with a beginning writer. These things, and yet you're not conscious. You're not doing it consciously. So do you want to talk about that a bit?
Yes, I think that, you know, it's very, very true that it takes quite a long time for someone to find those, whether they be syntactic effects or lexical effects that come to be known as somebody's voice. But, you know, I think in my mind, something that plays a tremendous role in my thinking and in my life is obsession. And we often couch obsession as a purely negative thing. And sometimes it can be. It can be, you know, a symptom of mental distress, which it has been for me. But somewhere along the line in my poetry, I realized, you know, the quality of obsessively thinking about something and turning it over again and again is not only, you know, a weakness of mine in my life, but it's a strength. I came to embrace it a bit. And I look at the syntactic turns, and you mentioned anaphora, for example, in my poetry. And I thought, you know, some of the things that perhaps wouldn't survive an early poetry workshop, which I think can often iron out the uniqueness in a voice, I think those are the things that writers, you know, should embrace. Of course, you have to keep an eye on when you go, you know, sort of too far with something. But that's, I think, that's me embracing the weirdness of my way of looking at the world. And the poets that I admire all have, you know, their very unique way of looking. And, that's why some of these greater writers get adjectival forms of their name. You know, what is it to be Kafka-esque? What is it to be, you know, Shakespearean? And so each of us on a much lower level, I think, can embrace what it is to be like us and to be, more of what we are.
Well, obsession is the greatest tool in the writer's workshop, in the toolbox. And boy, you know how to use it. Let us have two more. And let me tell everyone that in addition to what they're hearing, you're a songwriter and a novelist. And you also have a book we're going to hear about, of prompts. So some of your books are The Magic Words, The Last Song of the World, The Dark Heart of Every Wild Thing, Vincent, Inheritance, Fugue for Other Hands, The Crossing, and The Swallows of Luneta. My God, you must be 100 years old. Let's have two poems.
My pleasure. This is a poem that grew out of the winter solstice and thinking about the dark night of the soul, and it's called How to Survive the Night. Even the will return again. Even the love, the wonder. Darken, the heart can love this. And the new moon changing in the maples. And the grief like black oars in the rafters. And the branches that have let go of everything, saying, wait, just stay in your changes. You have hated your one life long enough. Try something wondrous. Trust it.
Mm.
And I want to share a poem that really grew out of my being a father. And, you know, living in a world in which people are suffering is nothing new. Of course, this has been going on since humanity began. And I wrote a poem that did not think about politics, did not think about anything other than the suffering of children, and the suffering of children as what some people accept as collateral damage in war around the world. And as I was holding my young son one night, I thought about what it would be to try to comfort a child in a situation like that. And this is called Words Whispered to a Child Under Siege. No. we are not going to die. The sounds you hear knocking the windows and chipping the paint from the ceiling, that is a game the world is playing. Our task is to crouch in the dark as long as we can and count the beats of our own hearts. Good. Like that. Lay your hand on my heart and I'll lay mine on yours. Which one of us wins is the one who loves the game the most while it lasts. Yes, it is going to last. You can use your ear instead of your hand. Here on my heart. Why is it beating faster? For you, that's all. I always wanted you to be born, and so did the world. No, those aren't a stranger's footsteps in the house. Yes, I'm here. We're safe. Remember chess? Remember hide and seek? The song your mother sang? Let's sing that one. She's still with us, yes. But you have to sing without making a sound. She'd like that. No, those aren't footsteps. Sing, sing louder. Those aren't footsteps. Let me show you how I cried when you were born. Those aren't footsteps. Those aren't sirens. Those aren't flames. Close your eyes. Like chess. Like hide and seek. When the game is done, you get another life.
Joseph, the love and the mercy, that could be your Ars Poetica, the care and everything that you believe is in that poem, even though I know it was dedicated to Leo, who we're getting to love. But that reminds me of Robert Benigni's Life is Beautiful. That film.
Yeah.
And it's the same tone of making a game out of a tragedy. But I do believe that is one of your most powerful poems, and it is connected, heart connected to your son. But it's interesting because when something is so specific, it becomes universal. So how do you teach? First of all, how many courses do you teach and where do you teach?
First of all, I want to say I couldn't agree more. You're absolutely right that the way to universality in poetry is into the particular. I teach now at Manhattanville College, which actually I've been teaching there for 16 years, and we've just been rechristened Manhattanville University, so we're very proud.
Mm-hmm.
And I teach a broad range of courses. I've taught literature seminars. I teach, of course, creative writing, poetry, and fiction writing. I think a lot, of course, about the intersections of those two genres as I work in them both myself. And I also, I teach academic writing, which is something that I think is so very important. I teach my students not just how to cross their T's and dot their I's, but how to think critically about language. And, you know, the average human being is confronted with probably more data, more information, more images, more text than probably the human organism is biologically designed to process nowadays as the person is confronted with that. So I think it's so important to teach people to engage language, to be active participants in the game of language rather than passive consumers of it. And I do a large amount of work folding creative work and poetry into those academic settings where that work might not be expected, because I think poetry is the ultimate synthetic act of creativity. The poet is bringing in disparate ideas and images and playing in some way. And so I think that getting students, sometimes reluctant students, to think about poetry suddenly makes them able and willing to make cognitive leaps in other realms of academic pursuits.
When you walk into a classroom of young writers, what is the first thing you say?
It changes, but I think the first thing that I ask them really is, what do you love to read? And that gives me a sense of where they are. And some of them, you know, it depends on where this class is taking place, whether it's online. I've taught at Ivy League institutions. I've taught at you know, other types of schools. But when I ask them that question, I get an immediate sense of where they are in their relationship to loving language and falling in love with its possibilities and mysteries. And I try to lead, you know, with that. And I try to I open up usually, I'll tell you very, very specifically, I give them a short poem by Walt Whitman called When I Heard the Learned Astronomer. And I show them the great irony of that poem, which your listeners can certainly find if they don't know. And it's a poem, very short poem, 8 or 9 or 10 lines maybe. And the speaker of the poem wanders into a public lecture, and he hears this lecturer discoursing about the stars and the scientific implications and complications of them. And Whitman's speaker, in a very Whitmanic pose, sort of says, oh, how soon unaccountable I became tired and sick, you know, of all this learning. And I wandered off by myself into the mystical moist night air, and from time to time looked up in perfect silence at the stars. And I say, what does this poem mean to you? And they all say, well, he doesn't want to study, he just wants to experience. And I think that's, of course, Whitman's great joke in that poem, because here he is writing what seems like what we would call free verse. But just as he gets to the end of that poem, the rhythm could fit perfectly in a Shakespearean sonnet, looked up in perfect silence at the stars. And so Whitman is making a deep point about the moments when we feel the most free are actually the moments when we're abiding by certain laws that we feel are the laws of our own self. And that, to me, is what I say. I say that's poetry. The moment where form and freedom become one. And perfect. I try to get them to change their way of looking at it in that way.
That is a perfect entry. What is on your bedside table? What are you reading right now?
Right now, I'm writing a novel about a certain philosopher. I have to keep it close to my vest just because sometimes when I talk it out, it goes away in my head.
Oh, yeah.
But so I'm reading right now a great deal. Of course, I'm always reading poetry, but I'm reading a great deal of philosophy. My undergraduate degree at Harvard was in philosophy and history. I'm always reading history. I was just saying in a lecture I gave last night that an education should first and foremost be an education in history. I'm reading a book about the Second World War. Anthony Beaver is a historian that I admire a great deal. Barbara Tuchman is a writer. I admire her book on the First World War is great. I'm reading a book of hers called The Distant Mirror, which was written in the 20th century, last century, and is sort of a comparison to the 14th century, thinking about these times in history when we have crises of meaning. So I'm usually, you know, reading a tremendous amount of things, but right now it's a lot of nonfiction history and philosophy. I love going deep into reading projects for the writing that I'm doing, especially when I work on novels. I like to really fill my head and heart up before I start putting pen to paper.
As I tell my students, read everything to be
Absolutely.
A poet. Read everything. And now we would like two more from Joseph Fasano.
This is a poem that I heard recently, and this pleases me very much, is going to be on posters in waiting rooms in hospitals. And I think that brings me comfort, that it perhaps will bring others comfort. It's a short poem called Urgent Message to a Friend in Pain. I have to tell you a little thing about living. I know, but hear me, a little thing I've carried in the dark. Remember when you saw the stars of childhood, when you knelt alone and thought that they were there for you, lamps that something held to prove your beauty? They are, they are, they are, they are, they are. And I will read another poem that is a very short one. I had a dream about the great poet Rumi, and I asked him a question in the dream. and he was kind enough to answer it. It's a very short 6-line poem called Rumi. In a dream, I asked him, what can I do if I can't change it? And he pointed to the graves and whispered, witness it.
Who first noticed you and gave you the baton? Who first saw you and saw the light and said, you are the one? Who gave you the courage to do what you do?
It's a great question, and there are a few people who are very dear to my heart, and I'll mention them. When I was an undergraduate at Harvard University, I began by studying mathematics and physics. I was in the astrophysics department, which I enjoyed and loved very dearly. But you see, I knew I wanted to write. My family is full of wonderful, intelligent, brilliant, and supportive people, but they're not literary people. And so, as it were, I didn't have a script for how to do this life. When I got to Harvard, I think the revelation was that there were people in that community who did that sort of thing and made it seem possible. And there's a man by the name of Kevin McGrath who just recently passed away. And he was a brilliant man, a poet. He was the poet in residence at Lowell House at Harvard University. Of course, Lowell House has a great history, Robert Lowell and Amy Lowell. And he was a Sanskrit scholar, so he was well-versed in the epic tradition, languages, and he encouraged my poetry a great deal. And then after undergraduate, when I was applying to graduate school, and I sent off my little packet of poems to MFA programs, really not knowing much about the landscape of who is who in contemporary poetry other than their work, that was when the great Lucy Brock-Broidow called me, that I'm sure many have received. And I was sitting in my little house in Goshen, New York, and I always say she plucked me out of there. She said, we need you, you know, come study with us. And she believed in me, and Richard Howard, the great Richard Howard, believed in me very deeply. And then I would also mention Mark Strand. I had the joy of working with Mark Strand, and toward the end, I remember we sat down for coffee one day and he said, you know, this is something that you really can do. And I really, you know, you should really do this. And he gave all sorts of wonderful advice. He was also a very funny man in a very dry way. But when he got sick at the end of his life, he called me up and said that he wanted me to take over teaching his classes. And that was when I really stepped into my life, not just as a writer, but as a teacher. So I've had so many amazing people who have believed in me over the years. Unfortunately, many of them are gone now, but of course they live on. And I endeavor to play my small part in that. That's one of the things I think of when I'm teaching. You know, a teacher's legacy is his students. And so I try in every way. And Grace, I know you've noticed this in my work off the page, as it were. I try in every way to pass it along, to give back, to build communities, because I know what it's like to feel like one is very much alone and lost in the process of becoming an artist.
You have been blessed by the towering figures, iconic figures. I know Lucy Brock-Broidow died not too long ago, maybe 3 years. And Mark, of course, he is always with us. And I will be looking for traces of them in your work. I do not see maybe the transparency and the luminosity of Mark Strand. I will be wondering who influenced you. But you are Joseph Bassano, and you are making an indentation in the universe that will never go away. I believe that. Finally, before your last poem, tell us, what is this strong spiritual underpinning in your poetry or in poetry, which is where poetry intersects with spirit in connection with the divine? I believe you feel that. You emanate that, and we follow you in that path. So what is that intersection? Do you believe in anything beyond the invisible?
Yes. And, you know, when I was younger and I was looking to make sense of the things that I felt, I won't even say that I thought, because I believe I felt them before I thought them. Of course, I became, like many, a great student of the works of Carl Jung. And, you know, it occurred to me to think that he's right if what he really means is that the images in the human psyche at the deepest level are not, perhaps as Freud would have them, reducible to other thoughts, but they are the very bedrock of something that is inexplicable. I think you can read the collected volumes of Carl Jung and he never quite comes out and says it, but I think what he's saying is those are God, those are the voice of God. Whatever one wants to think that name means, I was raised in a certain Catholic tradition. I find that very beautiful, but that's not my faith at the moment. But I think that somehow the forms that exist in the created universe are also the forms that exist in the deep human mind, and that when we read a poem, when we listen to a symphony, we are hearing echoes of creation, of something that is the depth of where creation comes from. When we feel that inevitability in a Mozart, a piano concerto, there is something that is connecting to the creation of the world. And I just feel that we are participating in that when we create somehow. So very often it's a mystery to me, but Carl Jung says somewhere, you know, let's think about the human body. When the human body calls for, let's say, salt or water, you just provide it. You don't ask questions. And I find that we have the same thirst, as it were, for a certain spiritual nourishment of, from mystery. And for me, poetry provides that. And so it has been a guide in my life, the reading of it, the writing of it, and I'm going to follow it as far as I can into the wilderness, wherever it guides me. Mm.
And Jung said that the balanced life was the thinking, the feeling, the sensual, and the intuitive, and every quadrant is in your poetry. So please give us a final poem.
I'd like to end with what is perhaps one of my shortest poems, but that ends with a line that I believe took me about 40 years to write. It's called Sudden Hymn in Winter. What if, after years of trial, a love should come and lay a hand upon you and say, this late, your life is not a crime?
The voice of Joseph Bassano, and it is the poet and the poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Production. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family, by the Sinipit Fund, by Natalie Canivore, the Anne Arundel Arts Council, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Our engineer is Mike Turpin, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.